Welcome to another Poetica podcast from RN. I'm Justine Sloan-Lees. Poet, novelist and historian Barry Hill has written across many genres, including labour history, biography, several collections of poetry, libretti and works for radio. In this podcast, we're featuring Barry's book Necessity, which won the ACT's Judith Wright Prize. Starting at the graveside of his trade union father in the western suburbs of Melbourne and ending in a Buddhist temple in the Himalayas, Barry Hill's journey is from a radical Australian sense of the collective to a contemplative engagement with India. In this program, he introduces selected poems with additional readings by William Zappa.
I'll read the first poem in the book because it seems to me to set up the roots of the book, if you like, and it begins with an epigraph from the Californian poet George Oppen, a leftist and modernist poet of the 30s and 40s. There is one word which one must define for oneself, the word us. And us is the first section of this book, which arises from my leftist working class background in the western suburbs of Melbourne. My father was an organiser for the AEU, metal workers, and my grandfather was a sheet metal worker and a pioneer of the Sheet Metal Workers Union. The poem is at my father's grave, and the allusion in the title, old photo, The Union Buries, is to the famous Henry Lawson story, The Union Buries Its Dead. A solid pack around his grave, good steel to a magnet, the sky leaden with the warmth somehow of common ground. I did not know them all, but the bulk of them knew me. Their leader told them of his bookish son and of his grandchildren gathered, see, near my elbow on the lava plain, on the hard crust of the flats, near thistles, stone walls, carbon black, and the crackers flame leaping where the cranes once flew over a lad's lizard hunting days. That was a time of solid stories, of organising rather than mourning. This group, with family in it, is resolution. I remember stupidly thinking, the clay's so sticky, no union man could turn in it.
The Eureka Oath isn't uttered often on the streets of Melbourne's CBD, but about 80,000 protesters used those words of the rebel miners at Ballarat in 1854 to unite against the federal government's industrial relations changes.
We stand truly by each other!
We stand truly by each other!
This is a poem set in about 2005 or 6 when work choices and so forth was the issue, and every working man and woman in Australia was worried about their hard-won working conditions, which were supremely threatened. And my father, who'd spent his life in that area, was surely turning in his grave. In fact, the setting is the petrochemical complex around Altona. And at the Union Carbide plant, my father was one of the unionists who organised the longest sit-in in Australian industrial history. So the place to me has that landscape is a heavily political landscape. I live down the coast, Queenscliff to be precise, in the western head of Port Phillip Bay. Lived there for about 400 years, and I've been swimming between the piers for at least 40 years, which has defined my time, I suppose. This is called a long swim.
Swimming out there, musculature in ultramarine, in weed green sea. You can think mackerel till you're blue in the face, but you go like tow rope, heavy, frayed, stretched from pier to pier, from year to year. Entering at the southern one, mind finned with intent, crossing crags and seagrass, gutters gouged by ebb tides, rays much wider than beds, their glideaways heavenly over sands that cloud the hourglass, in light that breaks the light, squid invisible, abalone opalescent, the flood tide your freedom, its reverse your test of worth. Emerging at the northern one, your body out of water, your flesh on arrival, the underside of flounder. Each tooth in your head a little colder. Your sense of time like coral.
The book moves from Australian working class locations into the international field of leftism and the revolutionary tradition. There are several ways it does this, but the first indication that the book is internationalist in its bearings is the poem Under the Sign of Necessity, which I wrote in Calcutta and which I dedicated to Nabanita Dev Sen, who's one of Bengal's great writers, and the former wife of Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize-winning economist. And Calcutta is a fabulously leftist city of great complexity of political consciousness, and I was struck by Nabanita's library when we had dinner there, how similar it was to my uncle and aunt's library in Melbourne when they were members of the Communist Party. My father, by the way, was never a communist. But one felt incredibly at home in this place. And Nabanita had been talking about her teaching years in the 70s in Calcutta, where many students took off to the bush to fight with the Maoists. They became Naxalites, as they were called then. And we were talking about our political situation in Melbourne. It was the time after the Bali bombing. You'll recognise the smile of Amrozi in the poem. My wife, who's sung a lot with Aboriginal people, sang a song from Broome, partly in language. And it was a sharing moment politically, quite an internationalist moment after dinner. In the comfortable room, our bellies full, we'd been talking ideas of language. And you had read a poem, the one about your young men hardened by killing in the name not of their mother, but justice. And I had read a poem in return, one about the bomber with the pretty smile and teeth like Mac the Knife. My wife sang a song, the one about tribal law and turtles. And then finally, except there's no finally, your household friend came in and sat like an Inca with her shawl, which lifted like clouds from a mountain, when she sang those long notes that fluted from valley to valley, yearning for each peak. After the loving silence we all then had for each other, I happened to remove myself to the bathroom, from where, in the smouldering streetlight below, a near-naked man washed at the pump, the gutter startlingly clean all around him, his body as fresh as the speech he directed like water to a man nearby. The listener had a small towel over his shoulder. He seemed to have all the time in the world. A song must have linked the rickshaw men, but then I had to turn away, neither knowing their poem nor the wars they might be in. The Port Lights refers to the MUA dispute, when, in Melbourne at least, it wasn't just unions that gathered at the docks there. This was a big community struggle. And I spent a couple of days down there and found myself tremendously excited, because writers live a very, very isolated life. And suddenly I realised I belong to a body of others. You know, we'd done anti-war marches and things like that, but this was different. It had a solidity to it because the maritime workers were the base of it. So the community was coming down and hanging out and reinforcing an enormous kind of sense of union strength, as in the old days, I suppose. So I scribbled and was very inspired by some of the speeches, and inspired because there was suddenly in my mind all that language about collectivity and made sense again, that this wasn't TV, this was actually the real thing, that one was on a front line. The one whose voice outgrapples hooks, the one who hammers in that peg effortlessly, the one whose head, shoulders, neck and chest are a building site, the one whose silence has 1 million fuck-ems in it, the one as patient as a bollard, the one whose laughter rises as easily as cigarette smoke, the one who hardly needs a feed yet, whose food is talk, the one who took my pencil to write a message for the other gate, the one who led the drill that gets women off the hook. Don't break ranks for anyone hauled out of line. Men, stay where you are. The women know the risks. Shoulder to shoulder, arms locked, hands clasped. Like this, look, the fingers hooked in, clawed. One leg across the other, the feet planted. Fore and aft as well. My hand in the belt in front, your hand in mine from behind. His and hers and ours. A ballast of bodies, a containing wall of containment. Blood sparks along the line of resolve. Body politic plugged in. You don't have to speak, you can shout, you can sing. We put the wall of containers to shame. They are so dead. A conversation, unspoken, historical, locks us in sinew. A strong communion, mentally orgiastic, in all weathers of love, for the polis, for the river and the sea. And don't they know it, those green-eyed ones in the city, the baying boys of the stock exchange, who think they own the lot, who pray each day to the Dow Jones, the Nikkei clocks, those curs chained to the percentage, their silk ties infected. Like most poets, I read Lawrence very young. So we found ourselves at Taormina in Sicily. Dramatic, wonderful place by a very deep blue sea in Sicily, facing Greece, as Lawrence was so conscious of. And we were shown into his house, the one they let. It's like an eagle's nest perched on the cliff and stood on the terrace, the very tiles that Lawrence probably would have broken dishes on. And this is tremendous because his desk is still there and the bedroom is upstairs. To my complete shame, I accepted the invitation to go to their bedroom, but I haven't written about that and don't think I ever will. So this is about Lawrence and Frieda taking off from Sicily in 1921, fed up with the kind of politics in Italy and its kind of neo-fascist things, but also the socialist stuff that Lawrence abhorred.
D.H. Lawrence leaves Sicily, 1921. Hibiscus flower. Alas, the Sunday coats of Sicilian Bolshevists. I am their superior, saluting the hibiscus flower, not them. D.H. Lawrence, hibiscus and salvia flowers. At Taormina, near the black-holed spring, each day astonished by the Greek dawn and quietly at one with his diamond head, the snake she hates, she brings her hot bare feet to the cool speckled tiles on the threshold, her weight there, as still as anything, with the morning smile of a woman retrieving her man, come to make a tortoise of him, soliciting his cry. Afterwards, a man might jangle a little. He comes back down the stairs, his day half gone, the sun on the boil in the kitchen. He seethes, as the socialist in the Corso seethed. The lout in him stalks onto the terrace, seeking to recover the acorn in him, seeking the word to rebalance, wanting, even as a tortoise wants, to put flesh back into its scream. At Taormina, even with the winds off the snow, he had lava heat, was soft and dark, pumice-voiced. His heart sought peace of sorts, but from throat to belly, from the crown of the head to the pith, and the soft diamond-tipped base of spine, that whole shaft of the body which knows terror, surrender, the current that gives way, recoils to attack, to shoot back in, back up. The death he brooded on was eruptive. He loved it here. He loved her here, the one who came down, eventually. Flaxen-haired and in the calico drawers he pleaded for, then imposed. She came back out onto the terrace to eat his bread, sweet basil near her ankles. He loved her like that he-goat, albeit a poor domesticated beast mounting the she-goat, his slitted eyes squinting back to the roots of his ears with her brimstone and brittle under him. He loved her busily, dishes, sewing, sweeping the terrace of leaves, Etna buried in cloud, every bat trapped in its cupboard. "Lorenzo," she cried, "Lorenzo, calm yourself, O mistress of dualism," as if to say, "Lorenzo, you are many creatures. There need be no savage split, no hard and fast division between Etna in winter and the winter sea. When the winds come off the snow and the sea's clarity settles into an icy sheen, the smoking mountain and the fish-filled sea are one. Lorenzo, you need not be done with one or with the other." He loved it here. So why on earth leave? "The demon," he snarled, "the demon travel lust." Something like that. As we looked out from their bread-roll kitchen, standing on the tiles in our sandals, on her speckled threshold, near his oven, and with that view all the way to Delphi, we made as little sense of it as him, except to say, with hands on his shoulders, "Calm yourself, Lorenzo, calm yourself." As well try to settle a turkey cock or a dog barking at a socialist. "None in rags and none in tags, swaggering up and down." Down he went, off with the basket and down the cliff in one run, from Etna to the sea in a slide, then across oceans to mountains, great green mountains steaming with Buddhist sloth, then on to the Antipodean continental place, with its ocean wave that slapped him down. But of course, he picked himself up. Smartly he recovered himself with the political wit of a digger come back from slaughter. In fact, he corrected the plum weight. He sprang up all scent and muzzle like the kangaroo, and he had, quick as a flash, eucalypt in him. Others could see the grey soul. He was full of bush silence, remoteness, and still he had Etna's heat in the belly, still he knew the lout in the socialist. He would love some men and not love other men at all. He loved to hate. There was no future standing there by the ocean, remarking upon our aggressive familiarities, marsupial withholdings, our lava plugs. He had to find his own Corso. Once more, he had to go. So he packed up again, dreaming hibiscus. It is possible near Etna in autumn, serene Etna, the day before All Saints' Day, to imagine she mourned. The volcano wanted him back. But Lorenzo would not promise anything. He'd find a restart his own way. He would find the snake dance, lie down with the mountain lion, though he saw it dead, and he would, under bony mountain moons, lie with her of the meaty breath, flaxen mane. He would quarry in the new world. The quartz of the individual, minerals for flowering friendships, some collective hibiscus, if only men and women were together in the right way, if only the snows between them melted the right way. And if not? If not, back he would come, to the black-holed spring, back underground. A leopard led him in.
Мгла опадла вчесне, працювали в огороді. Не знали нікого, кому варто було би заздрощити.
Miłosz, of course, one of the great poets of the 20th century, but greater still in Polish, which I don't have. I went to see him in Krakow. My wife was interviewing him, and in the course of that interview, there was a lull, and he said he'd just come back from Lithuania to an event devoted to Joseph Brodsky. And I asked him, what did he read there? And he read me the poem in Polish that he'd read to Brodsky. And I'd been listening to a lot of Polish in the course of travelling in Poland and just heard this electrifying kind of implosive language with a certain metrical kind of power that Russian has. But I can still, even saying this now, can still feel my spine tingling at listening to Miłosz read in Polish. That's what this poem is partly about. It's also about my sense as a sort of innocent Australian abroad, my sense of what political maturity might consist of, because Miłosz had gone from being an ambassador to communist Poland to emigre in America. But he'd been present in the Battle of Warsaw. So there's nothing in a way that Miłosz had not experienced politically. So I had a reverence for his Catholic capacity for finding happiness in the carnal world. And he was a very carnal poet, at the same time as his political depth and disillusionment with the left. And that's good for someone like me who's brought up on leftist romanticisms. And so as a combination of his presence, the single flower on the table, the power of the enormous fire in the Polish as he read it, was a big moment.
On reading the late poems of Miłosz. Coming to the poem marking his 88th birthday, which is the poem after the one about himself with a glass of whiskey at the airport, legs in miniskirts, buttocks and thighs, old lecher, ecstatic union and desiring everything. I also know and remember the others dealing sternly with betrayal, guilt, vanity, representing a peach, speech, illusion, self-delusion, sin and evil. They are about everything, including incomprehension, mysteries and the mystery, and happiness. I come to the 88th birthday poem and see I am reading all of him one day before he is 90. Happy birthday. Happy birthday for tomorrow, Czesław. Your fat, grave, satiric and angelic book swings me ape-like back and forth from deep time to a possibly lost future, from my own failures in love and self-love out to the slow garden of altruism. In my imagination, which flies far from my experience, your poems exile me in war-torn cities and brand unspeakables of politics into my cheek, tongue, genitals. By the scruff of my neck I read, honour memory, and quake, as I age too at your PN to forgetfulness. In the morning sunlight these pages turn. I sip coffee, take sweet tea to the woman gently waking in the room above, and notice in a pause between poems my hand on the page. My half-calloused knuckles, pudgy without karate, the second joints tufted with my father's grey hair. My nails tended for tenderings, but the back of the hand a bluish lattice, a mortal grapey skein over bone. I am surprised by the otherness of my hand, once extended to yours that summer day in Krakow when you were a mere 86 and hungry-eyed, as you say, slightly deaf and as still as the single tulip in the slim vase on the table on the bare pine floor. I meet some poems and they translate themselves. Look, no hands. With others, we can only bow to strangeness. What volume is that you are reading from? And I showed you. Poecie Wybrane. The Polish ones, with an English brook beside them. You had just come from Vilna, at a meeting to praise Brodsky. Perhaps you simply wanted to honour your friend again. Then maybe you wanted even more to metrically enliven the polished floor. In any case, into the little room you put your reading, placing it out there as one might reach to finger the satiny stem of the flower. You seem to begin so slowly, unfolding the power, then letting it surge into the fuse of phrases, into the filaments of consonants until the vowels, like bulbs, were inaudibly exploding, going off one by one, the exquisitely selected ones like gunshots in the open field the poem made, your duel with your language suddenly, ecstatically over. Now I can't move my hand from the page. This slow, plain, safe, tame, English-speaking page. A mort man in the Antipodean winter morning, wanting, I feel, Jacobean light and shade, needing Marlowe to come strutting, commas to ejaculate, and daggers of phrases in love with blood, so that something other than these unavoidably staid sermons, these ghost poems, these silent half-confessions, your grace whispers might rise between my fingers. You write, Czesław, that some words, some truths, are too cruel to reveal to the human heart. I read this calm proposition on the page. I could butter my bread with its ease as it comes to me here. I kid myself that I have your quest down pat. But then I hear, in the line, the violin and the machine gun fire, the bread breaking and the break in the throat of the song of the black tulip. On a peaceful morning, I age, musing of murder.
Well, Shelley, you see, is irresistible as a political figure, because while he didn't have power, far from it, he was a pure libertarian, a pure-hearted and pure-minded libertarian who wrote some of the best political poetry of the age. His long poem called His Mask of Anarchy. It was one of the first genuinely rebellious poets written by anybody who'd been to Oxford. And he's very present in several places, Italy, of course, where he settled, and also in Chamonix, where he and Mary ended up, passed through in 1818, where he scribbled into the visitor's book of the hotel in Greek, Democrat, Philanthropist, Atheist, which, of course, gave him somewhat even worse reputation back in London than he had had in the first place. But so Shelley's passion, the romanticism of drowning at sea, his unqualified sort of intelligence and rapture with ideas and freedom. You can't go past Shelley as an exemplary case of the romantic, potentially revolutionary figure. The poet's freedom of movement in this book is a dimension of it too, because I'm not ashamed to say that I do literary pilgrimages. And so it was fabulous to come to Lerici and find Shelley's old house still on the beach, Casa Magni. And this is very moving because you could swim opposite the house. The very water where he set off and didn't come back, etc. And the house is still there, and you could sneak around the back garden and look at the statues, the broken statues. So Shelley is in this book for reasons of tourism, but essentially because when I began to do the revolutions, radical idealism was one of the places to start.
At Shelley's Casa Magni, Lerici. Now the sea has lost its light, the underside of waves could be the stone of the castle, or stone wearing still at the bottom of the bay. A stolid cargo ship squats on the horizon. Flagging it here on shore, the cypress pines await the evening air, the sea mist, the furling of umbrellas. In the garden of Casa Magni, up the steps from the back door, which looks to the entrance arch, the bay's panorama, sea-lapping steps in a storm. A Venus stands in a rocky recess, marble against rubbly grey, her arms missing, a hand somehow severed yet cemented to her torso, the wreck of her silent. Over the house, a white tarpaulin signals surrender to restoration. You can imagine his spirit revived. Democrat, philanthropist, atheist, spuming the sea. We need his mask of anarchy.
Some people might read this as a travel book. It's been reviewed like that in Antipodes in America, but it's not a travel book. I realised when I was pulling it together that it's a book that actually indicates a movement of self from the collective to the contemplative, I suppose. And so the last section of the book is called Approaching Siddhartha, the prince who became the Buddha. And so that's literally what it is. It's quite biographical insofar as it's not that I've left the left or anything as melodramatic as that. It's that my life has moved, you know, has been in the realm of Buddhism for 30 or 40 years anyway. And I'd never been to India before. So India is a ravishing. One gets knocked around in India, both positively and negatively. And these poems are processing India with a Buddhist sense of things, and also Tagore, the great Bengali poet. So the last movement of the book is to write a book without a back cover, really. It's meant to indicate the flow outwards. Implicitly, the poems here are saying, well, does it all have to be poetry? Does it all have to be anything, really? There's a couple of lines from the Sri Lankan basic Buddhist text, the Dhammapada, which says, better than 100 useless poems is one single poem that gives peace. So the potential for getting out of poetry through it to peace is part of the direction, the pull movement of that last section of the book. Shelley wouldn't have minded that.
Varanasi, three poems. Day by day dust. How is it that the light blesses the dust? What became of the world that the dust is blessed? In the morning, before the sun rises, pollen is heavy with dust. This afternoon, driving back from Sarnath, even Hero Hondas sweeten the dust. As for that cow at the intersection, her good cud is dust. The mounds of green chilies shine as if they are clear of dust. No dust befalls the charm shop. More ruins. In the deer park, there is much single-pointed concentration on money. The kids, small flies with sticky hands, can't leave you alone. I saw two deer in the middle distance. I might have begged from them, but they shied away towards more ruins of a monastery. A new great day. The Pepsi girl has Bollywood breasts and a pesticide kiss. She's more deadly than Kali, but I am outward bound on this spring morning crossing the old trunk road. In the dusty white ambassador, the driver who loves Hanuman plays tabla with his new horn. With three monkeys on the dash and a white marble lingam in my dilly, all is well with the river.
And in this Poetica podcast from RN, we've been listening to Necessity by Barry Hill. Barry was the narrator and read several of the poems, with additional readings by William Zappa. The sound engineer was Stephen Tilley, and production was by Anna Meseriti. Go to the Poetica website if you'd like more information. In our next podcast, we mark Mental Health Awareness Week with a feature on one of the greatest of the confessional poets, Anne Sexton.